Good to have you with us tonight. We'd like to invite you to open up a Bible to the book of Proverbs as we begin. I want to take a thought that Solomon offers us in that book as the basis for a few things from God's Word tonight. Solomon writes in Proverbs chapter 10 is where we want to look. Proverbs 10, we're going to read just verse 22. Proverbs 10, verse 22. And there Solomon writes, "It is the blessing of the Lord that makes rich, and he adds no sorrow to it." Solomon was a man who knew about as much as anybody has ever known about the possessions and the pleasures and the pursuits that people chase after in life, and whether those things can really deliver on their promise of genuine enjoyment and satisfaction. In the book of Ecclesiastes, for instance, and that's a book we're going to refer to a few times tonight, but in that book, Solomon describes all the different things that he was able to do in seeking for real meaning in life. Building things, collecting things, amassing wealth, enjoying wine, women, and song, you name it. It was within Solomon's power to do it, pursuing wisdom and knowledge and education. And Solomon knew that under certain conditions, the things and the activities that we think are going to bring pleasure can not only be empty, but actually troubling. For example, this is what he writes in Ecclesiastes chapter 5, just a few pages over from where we were just reading. In Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 10, Solomon says, "He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. This too is vanity," he says. "When good things increase, those who consume them increase. So what is the advantage to their owners except to look on? The sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich man does not allow him to sleep." There is much of that kind of observation in this book. Solomon noting that the things we think are going to bring happiness and joy and satisfaction in life very often fail to do that and sometimes bring a lot of worry. When he writes, "It is the blessing of the Lord that makes rich, and he adds no sorrow to it," what exactly does that mean? What should we learn from it? Well, first we need to think about another fact that is emphasized in Ecclesiastes. And that is that apart from God, life is empty. Life is vain. That really is the theme of the book in many ways. Solomon sets forth all the things that he pursued in life and shows how hollow they are apart from God. I'm told that a long time ago in England, many people wrote over their homes a Latin expression. In Latin it read, "Nisi Dominus frustra," which translated into English means, "Without God, it is vain." And that is taken from Psalm 127, which you may notice is a psalm that was written by Solomon. In the very first verse of Psalm 127, Solomon writes, "Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman keeps awake in vain." Solomon says that vanity is the result of pursuits where God is left out. Sometimes that word vain means simply without result, that God does not allow a project to reach its completion. Think about the Tower of Babel way back in Genesis chapter 11. Here is this group of people basically trying to build a monument to their own greatness, to build a tower and make a name for themselves, and God frustrated their plans so that they would not be able to finish. But sometimes vain simply means that God does not allow us to get the result that we were looking for. We read about a man named Balaam in the book of Numbers who experienced that. In Numbers chapter 22, Balaam was a prophet, but he was hired by the king of Moab to pronounce a curse on the people of Israel. Why a prophet would allow himself to be used in that kind of fashion is something of a mystery, but Balaam was greedy enough and selfish enough that he did so. He accepted the payment from the king of Moab to try and curse the people of Israel, but God didn't allow him to do it. And every time Balaam opened his mouth to pronounce a curse, Numbers 22 says, Balaam ended up pronouncing a blessing instead. That was not the result he was looking for. That certainly was not the result that the king of Moab, who hired him, was looking for. We can see, I hope, how vain life's pursuits are without God in the matter of wealth, riches. But not just the money kind of riches, but the kind of things or activities that we pursue in search of pleasure. The Bible tells us that riches are actually of two kinds. There are temporal or physical riches, and there are true riches, eternal riches, spiritual riches. Jesus makes a pretty clear distinction between the two in Matthew chapter 6. I know that's a passage that should be familiar to us. In Matthew chapter 6 and verse 19, he says, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal." He says, "Store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in or steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Treasure on earth, treasure in heaven. There's the distinction. Jesus said the problem with treasure on earth is it's subject to decay, it's subject to theft, it's subject to being taken from us in one way or another. Not so the treasure that we lay up for ourselves in heaven. Paul identifies that same difference in 1 Timothy chapter 6 when he writes to a young evangelist, Timothy, about how he is to speak to the people in various phases of life. And in 1 Timothy 6, Paul gives Timothy some instruction for how to speak to those who are wealthy. And in verse 17 of 1 Timothy 6, he says, "Instruct those who are rich in this present age not to be conceited or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. Instruct them to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is life indeed." You see the contrast between putting trust in physical wealth, material things, and putting one's trust in God and laying up true riches. When we are not focused on God, the striving for the pleasures that this life has to offer ends up degenerating into an unfulfilling pursuit, something that is ultimately empty. One writer said, "We merely become the janitors of our own possessions." Just the same way that not all pain is bad in the sense of being something that is pointless and meaningless, something from which we cannot profit ultimately, so not all pleasure is good. Many pleasures turn out to have a downside. There is the possibility of riches with sorrow. That's why Solomon says it is God who makes rich, and He does not add sorrow to it. The pleasures of this life may bring with them a lot of dissatisfaction, a lot of emptiness, a lot of frustration. Sometimes our pursuit of pleasure and enjoyment in this life may involve us with some guilt, the loss of self-respect, maybe damage to our bodies or to our emotions. Whatever may be the immediate gratification, we ultimately have to deal with the consequences. Paul writes about that in a very broad sense in Romans chapter 6. Talking to the Roman Christians about their past life, he characterizes it as enslavement that they have now left behind and been set free in Christ. He says to them in Romans 6 and verse 21, "Therefore, what benefit then were you deriving from the things of which you are now ashamed?" They had led a life that was pursuing sinful pleasures, self-gratification, a life that ultimately had enslaved them. Now they've been set free from that, and he encourages to look back on that former life and see how pointless it was. "What benefit were you then deriving from the things of which you are now ashamed? For the outcome of those things," Paul says, "is death." And he doesn't just mean the idea that we all die physically at some point. He's saying the outcome of those things is separation from God. It is death in the most significant sense. Even the possessions and pleasures with which God blesses us may come to look more like curses than blessings in some circumstances. It is how we approach them that makes the difference. Can we go back to Ecclesiastes for a moment? Same chapter, Ecclesiastes chapter 5, where we were a moment ago. And we're just going to keep reading where we left off. Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 13. In Ecclesiastes 5, verse 13, Solomon says, "There is a grievous evil which I have seen under the sun, riches being hoarded by their owner to his own hurt. When those riches were lost through a bad investment, and he had fathered a son, then there was nothing to support him. As he had come naked from his mother's womb, so he will return as he came. He will take nothing from the fruit of his labor that he can carry in his hand. This is also a grievous evil. Exactly as a man is born, thus he will die. So what is the advantage to him who toils after the wind? Throughout his life he also eats in the darkness with great vexation, sickness, and anger." That's a reminder that a lot of Ecclesiastes is very depressing unless we read it in light of Solomon's ultimate conclusion. And that is that when we fear God and keep His commandments, when we put God at the center of things, all of these other things cease to be curses and burdens and vexations. But until we do that, that's the reality. Until we do that, there is pointlessness and emptiness and heartache. Because until we put God at the center of things, God will withhold from us the ability to really and truly appreciate and enjoy the things that He has given us in life. Chapter 6, verse 1. "There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is prevalent among men, a man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor, so that his soul lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God has not empowered him to eat from them, for a foreigner enjoys them. This is a vanity and a severe affliction." Unless we, as one person said, seek pleasure and wealth and possessions and success on God's terms, then we're going to have sorrow with it. Solomon said, "It is the blessing of the Lord that makes rich," and he adds no sorrow to it. So how do we find riches without sorrow? I'll suggest just a handful of things tonight, and then the lesson will be yours. And understand that as we talk about riches, we are not just necessarily talking about money or the things money can buy, although that certainly enters into our discussion. How do I find riches without sorrow? First of all, I need to be careful what I want. I need to be careful about the things that I desire in life. In Exodus chapter 20, when God spoke to the people of Israel, gave them the fundamental 10 commandments of the law, this last one, Exodus chapter 20 and verse 17, was, "You shall not covet." Don't covet your neighbor's house or his wife or his livestock or his servants or anything that belongs to your neighbor. It was not wrong for the Hebrews to desire a house or a wife or a servant or any of the things that they might acquire in life. But God told them, don't desire what belongs to someone else. To expand that concept just a little bit, don't desire what you cannot rightfully obtain. There are some things the desire of which is just inherently wrong, and we need to be aware of that. But we also need to be aware that there are other things that, while the desire of them may not be in and of itself wrong, it can be dangerous. Go back with me to 1 Timothy chapter 6. And see some more of what Paul writes to Timothy about money, for instance, and wealth. 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 9. In 1 Timothy 6 verse 9, Paul says, "Those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil, and some, by longing for it, have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs." It has often been a misquotation of verse 10 to say that money is the root of all evil. That's not exactly what Paul says, is it? He says the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil. Whatever it is that you want, there are other considerations you need to think about that will determine whether that thing will be bringing sorrow with it. What is it that you want in life? What is it that you are most thinking about and most desirous of right now? What is it that you are seeking this week as you get up and go to work tomorrow morning or get up and go to school tomorrow morning? What are the goals that you have just for this week or maybe just for tomorrow? What is it that you are trying to accomplish? Maybe it's buying a car or a house or some land or a boat or a computer or a television. Maybe it's a cat, a new CD, a shirt, a power tool, a pair of shoes, a steak dinner. Maybe it's a job. Or a promotion at your job, or a bonus, or an award, or a degree. Maybe what you're pursuing is a friendship, or a romantic relationship, or even a family. Maybe it's a political office, or a position on a board, or a committee, or some other role of community leadership. Maybe it's a win in the big game, success in sports, or in music, or in art. Maybe it's a vacation. Maybe it's a ticket to the game, a day hunting or fishing, a night out. What is it that you want? How dangerous could it be to want it? See, a lot of those things we just listed are really simple things, really simple sounding things. And yet sometimes we will trade things of much greater value for them, maybe without even realizing it. Be careful what you want, and be careful why you want it. In James chapter 4, verse 1, this is what James has to say. James chapter 4 and verse 1. He says, "What is the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? Is not the source your pleasures that wage war in your members? You lust and do not have, so you commit murder. You are envious and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask with wrong motives, so that you may spend it on your pleasures." James gives a whole list of problems. I don't know if the murder that he is talking about in verse 2 is literal. I tend to want to think that he's using a figure of speech, applying it to bad treatment of one another. But still, you desire and you do not have, so you treat others badly, at the least. You are envious and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You don't have because you don't ask, and you ask and do not receive because you're asking for all the wrong reasons, he says, because all you want to do is pursue self-gratification. So James says, be careful why you're asking. Be careful why you want whatever it is that you want. Paul says much the same thing in Ephesians chapter 4. In Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 28, he says, "Let him who stole steal no longer, but rather he must labor, performing what is with his own hands what is good." Notice the last part of the verse. "So that he will have something to share with the one who has need." Paul holds out as a motivation for working and providing for myself, not just providing for myself or for my family, but having something to share with someone else who has need. We talked about that just a little bit this morning. Why is it that you want that thing that you want? Just so you can pursue your own glory, or so that you can use it to serve others? So that you can make yourself more equipped to serve others by it. Be careful what you want, and be careful why you want it, and be careful how you go about getting it. In 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 21, Paul says, "Have regard for what is honorable, not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men." Have regard for what is honorable. One thing that suggests to us is that in my pursuits in life, as I am seeking to earn money or advance myself in my career or build a home or build a family or whatever it is that I'm seeking to do, I need to be sure that I'm going about it in an honorable way, a way that will not bring discredit to my character. Certainly, Paul says, in a way that's consistent with God's will, honorable in the sight of God, but also honorable in the sight of men. I go about this in a way that will not hinder and damage my relationships with others or my ability to influence others. There's an honorable way to go about getting what you want, and sometimes there's the quick and easy way to go about getting what you want. There's a good example of that in 1 Kings chapter 21 in the Old Testament. It's an example in the life of King Ahab. And you can probably tell already, if it's an example from Ahab's life, then it's going to be a negative kind of thing. It's obviously going to be something that we don't want to imitate. In 1 Kings chapter 21, we're just going to kind of summarize the story, but you can look at the text if you like. In 1 Kings chapter 21, Ahab basically became covetous of something that did not belong to him. The thing that he wanted, the it that was consuming Ahab's thinking, was a vineyard. And that vineyard belonged to a man named Naboth. It was in Jezreel, next to the palace of Ahab in Samaria. And Ahab spoke to Naboth in verse 2 and said, "Give me your vineyard that I may have it for a vegetable garden, because it is close beside my house." He even offered Nathan what, at least Ahab thought, was a better vineyard in exchange. "Or if you like, I'll give you the price in money." But Naboth didn't want to part with his vineyard. It was his property and he had every right to continue to hang on to it. But it seems not to have been just plain old greed that caused Naboth to want to hang on to this piece of property. He said in verse 3, "The Lord forbid that I should give you the inheritance of my fathers." Remember that a particular parcel of land within tribal territory was something very valuable to the people in Israelite society in the Old Testament. Not something to be easily parted with. Well, verse 4 says that Ahab came into his house sullen and vexed because of what Naboth had told him. And he laid down on his bed and turned away his face and ate no food. So here is a grown man, the king of a nation, pouting like a little child because he didn't get his way. He wanted that other fellow's toy, in this case a vineyard, and he wouldn't give it to him. Jezebel, his wife, came in and said, "How is it that your spirit is so sullen and you're not eating food?" Ahab explained, "Naboth won't give me his vineyard." The end result was that Jezebel framed Naboth with false accusations. And the man was taken out and stoned to death. And then the way was cleared for Ahab to get Naboth's vineyard. You think that's honorable? And do you think Ahab, as callous and ungodly a man as he was, really got a lot of enjoyment and satisfaction out of the vineyard, knowing that that was how he acquired it? We're not told. It's hard to imagine that being a very satisfying acquisition. Be careful what you want, and be careful why you want it. Be careful how you get it. Be careful to be sure you can afford it. And here's what I mean by that. Not just that you have enough money to purchase it. It may be a thing that can't be bought with money. Some of the things we listed earlier are pursuits that you don't just buy. What I mean by afford it is this. Be careful that you are not sacrificing higher priorities in order to get it. Turn to Matthew chapter 13 and see what we're talking about. Matthew chapter 13, we're going to read verses 45 and 46. This is one of the parables of Jesus, in a chapter filled with parables about the nature of God's kingdom. And in this brief parable, Jesus says, verse 45 of Matthew 13, "Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant seeking fine pearls, and upon finding one pearl of great value, he went and sold all that he had and bought it." And Jesus says, God's kingdom is like that. Being part of God's kingdom is more valuable than absolutely anything else that this life has to offer. One implication of that is you don't want to trade citizenship in God's kingdom for anything, because it's a bad deal. In the Gospel of Luke, chapter 12, we see it illustrated again. In Luke chapter 12, Jesus is right in the middle of a sermon and somebody in the crowd blurts out, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." And Jesus used that as an opportunity to teach about covetousness and greed. Verse 16, he told them a parable. He said the land of a certain rich man was very productive, and he began reasoning to himself, "What shall I do since I have no place to store my crops?" He said, "This is what I will do. I'll tear down my barns and build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods, and I will say to my soul, 'Soul, you have laid up many goods for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry.'" This guy's got a plan to build a larger and larger base of wealth for himself so he can take it easy and just enjoy life. But he forgot one thing. He forgot God. And so he forgot the one who can make life worth enjoying. Because in verse 20, God said to him, "You fool, this very night your soul is required of you. Now who will own what you have prepared?" So Jesus concludes, "So is the man who stores up treasures for himself and is not rich toward God." Whatever it is that you are pursuing in life, you need to be sure that you can acquire it without trading away the most valuable thing you have, Christian, and that's citizenship in God's kingdom. Again, we're not talking about whether or not you can scrape up enough spare change to plunk down and literally afford the thing money-wise. There are other things to consider. Are you going to end up trading your soul in order to acquire whatever it is that you're after? Make sure that you can afford it. Make sure that you can obtain this thing without doing injustice to your highest priority. Riches without sorrow means we need to be careful that whatever we have does not control us. In 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 12. 1 Corinthians 6 verse 12. Paul says, "All things are lawful for me, but not all things are profitable. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be mastered by anything." We might rephrase Paul's words a little bit to help get the point across. Picture Paul saying, "Not everything that is lawful for me is profitable. Not everything that is lawful for me is something I need, because I don't want to be enslaved to anything." There are perfectly legitimate pursuits in life that can become gods to us if we allow them to do so. It's not that those things are inherently wrong. It's that we get them out of proportion in our thinking. And I've got to be honest, for most people that I have encountered who are already Christians, this is the greater problem of worldliness. It's not... I mean, sometimes open immorality is a problem. Sometimes just flouting God's moral law about sexuality or stealing or something else is the problem. You know what I find more often than not? It's what Paul's talking about here. It's managing a whole bunch of different pursuits in life without allowing any of them to get in the way of what is our chief pursuit, without allowing them to enslave us. There's nothing wrong with working and earning a living, but I have seen husbands and fathers enslave themselves to their jobs and neglect spiritual responsibilities to their brothers and sisters and their families, all because they thought they could make up for it by earning some extra money. There's nothing wrong with wanting a larger house or a newer car. But are we going to enslave ourselves and our income stream to it to a degree that it renders us incapable of serving others? You see the point. Paul says, "All things may be lawful, but I'm not going to be mastered by anything." Peter echoes the thought in 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 19. He talked about false teachers who promise people freedom while they themselves are slaves of corruption. And then he says, "By what a man is overcome, by this he is enslaved." It is possible for a good thing in life. It may be an education. It may be our work. It may be a hobby or a recreational pastime to consume us to a degree that we become enslaved to it, overcome by it. And we may not be hurting anybody by that, but it's knocked God off the throne in our hearts. And that's a great problem. That's the greatest problem we can bring on ourselves. Be careful not to be controlled by whatever it is that you're after. How is getting this going to impact my discipleship? How is having this going to impact my discipleship? I recall a good brother that I knew several years ago. And I remember a certain situation in his life. This was a man that had a wife and two beautiful children and was trying his best to provide a good living for them. I think was providing a good living for them, but he was just never quite satisfied with what he was able to provide. Always wanted to be able to do more. He was a hard worker. And he was talking about this promotion that he might be able to get at work. And he was so excited about it because that promotion would enable him to provide them with more. And he got the promotion. And that new job became such a burden to him. He was making more money. But the weight that it put on his shoulders was so heavy that it was starting to be a vexation, as Solomon would say it. He wasn't happier like he thought he would be. And it was starting to affect his involvement in the work of God. That's what I mean by making sure that we can afford it. That's what I mean by making sure we don't become controlled by whatever it is that you're after. Be sure to remember where it came from. Whatever it is, if it is a blessing in life, then it is a blessing from one source. There's a good passage in Deuteronomy that's an illustration of that. As God speaks to the people of Israel, and remember in Deuteronomy, God is speaking to the people of Israel, preparing them for the conquest and occupation of the land of Canaan. And a lot of the instructions in Deuteronomy are specifically about what life in the promised land is going to be like, what their responsibilities are going to be. And here in Deuteronomy chapter 8, we're going to read beginning in verse 10. When you have eaten and are satisfied, you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which He has given you. We ought to be able to stop there, but we should read on. Beware, verse 11, that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping His commandments and His ordinances and His statutes, which I am commanding you today. Otherwise, when you have eaten and are satisfied and have built good houses and lived in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply and your silver and gold multiply and all that you have multiplies, then your heart will become proud and you will forget the Lord your God, who brought you out from the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. He led you through the great and terrible wilderness with its fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty ground where there was no water. He brought water for you out of the rock of flint. In the wilderness He fed you manna, which your fathers did not know, that He might humble you, that He might test you, to do good for you in the end. Otherwise, you may say in your heart, my power and the strength of my hand made me this wealth. But you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is He who is giving you power to make wealth, that He may confirm His covenant which He swore to your fathers as it is this day. Who was giving them what they were about to possess? God was. And this injunction from Moses is that they must never, ever forget it. And so it is for us. James writes that every good gift and every good thing given comes from above, comes from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shifting shadow. It is too easy and too often that we forget that. And we say what God warned the Israelites about: my strength, my hand, my skill, my wisdom, my intelligence got me this. Where'd you get all those things? God blessed you with them. Don't forget where it came from. And whatever it is that you're after in life, be careful to be content if you don't get it. Can I say that life is satisfying? Can I glorify God without having whatever it is? 1 Timothy chapter 6, one more time. 1 Timothy chapter 6, we'll begin reading in verse 6. Paul says, godliness actually is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. For we have brought nothing into the world, so we cannot take anything out of it either. If we have food and covering, with these we shall be content. I have to admit that when I read verse 8, I feel a little bit, sometimes more than a little bit, ashamed of myself and wonder, would I be content if food and covering was all I had? I have a lot more than that. And I know all of you well enough to know that you do too. Contentment, one author says, is finding as many benefits in not getting what we want as we do in getting it. That's a good way to summarize. Or as Thoreau put it, a man is rich in proportion to the number of things which he can afford to leave alone. There's a story about a man in Egypt centuries ago who gave up all his possessions and went out and lived in the wilderness pursuing a life of austerity and devotion to God. But every once in a while he enjoyed traveling to Alexandria and walking among all the shops and bazaars and looking at all these wonderful things that were for sale. And somebody who knew him thought that was strange and said, "Why do you do that?" And he said, "It rejoices my heart to see all of those things that I don't need." That's contentment. Whatever it is that you're pursuing this week, this year, in this lifetime, will you be content if you don't get it? Will you still be able to glorify God and keep Him first if you don't get it? And be careful, whatever it is, to enjoy it properly. We need to be careful to enjoy life's good blessings within the framework of passages like this one in Ecclesiastes chapter 11. As Solomon nears the close of that book, here's what he says. This is Ecclesiastes 11, beginning in verse 9. "Rejoice, young man, during your childhood, and let your heart be pleasant during the days of young manhood, and follow the impulses of your heart and the desires of your eyes." Can we stop there for a moment? Solomon is telling the young man, enjoy life. Go after the pursuits that life has before you. Make something of yourself. Do the things that are in your power to do that God has given you the power to do that Solomon writes about in this book. But, he says, know that God will bring you to judgment for all these things. In other words, God will hold you accountable for how you pursue these things and how you manage them. So, remove grief and anger from your heart and put away evil from your body, because childhood and the prime of life are fleeting. And at the conclusion, Solomon says, the conclusion when all has been heard is this, chapter 12 and verse 13. Fear God and keep His commandments, because that is the whole of man, he says. The lesson of the book of Ecclesiastes is this. We get the most out of life when we quit paying so much attention to it. That's how Gary Henry summed it up. I like that. We get the most out of the physical pursuits in life when they are not what life is all about. We get the most enjoyment out of our wealth when wealth is not what our lives are all about. We get the most enjoyment out of the possessions we have, or the roles in which we find ourselves, or our careers, or our academic pursuits, when we understand that life is not all about that thing. Whatever it is that you're after in life, remember that it is not what life is all about. Fearing God and keeping His commandments is what life is all about. If you miss that, then whatever other things you accomplish in this life ultimately are hollow, because you will have missed the purpose for which God put you here. Be careful to enjoy those things properly. The possessions and the pleasures of life, even the ones that God blesses us with, and ultimately they're all blessings from God, become a burden around our necks if we don't recognize God's principles for enjoying and profiting from them. The only way to have riches without sorrow is to enjoy them the way God says. That's the lesson. It is the Lord, the blessing of the Lord, that makes rich. And He adds no sorrow to it. Whether we have a little or a lot in terms of wealth or status or accomplishments or education or anything else, it's a blessing from God. And if we appreciate it as such and honor Him above all other things, that's real riches without sorrow.